Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're simply going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and you'll be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into our chat room and pose questions there. Today, we are discussing the indiscriminate or routine shackling of children and adolescents when they appear in juvenile court. Many people are unaware that kids can be brought to juvenile court in shackles even before a youth is charged with any wrongdoing or assessed for safety or flight risk. Shackles are mechanical restraints, which most commonly include leg irons, belly chains, and handcuffs. These restraints are heavy and can weigh as much as 25 pounds. In jurisdictions that routinely shackle, a child's age, weight, gender, or physical abilities may not be considered before applying restraints. There are vigorous debates about rules that require metal shackles to be used in juvenile court hearings. Experts have said shackling a youth may cause humiliation and trauma. The practice may impede the attorney-client relationship, interfere with due process, and run counter to the rehabilitative ideals of juvenile court. For example, on the adult side, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that the sight of shackles on a defendant in a courtroom can unfairly influence a jury. The mission of the National Juvenile Defender Center, NJDC, is to promote justice for all children by guaranteeing excellence in the juvenile defense. This includes ensuring that children are afforded full protection of their constitutional, statutory, and human rights. As part of that effort, NJDC started a national organizing campaign seeking the end of automatic shackling of children in delinquency court. Today we have three guests on the show that are going to discuss the national campaign, provide more information about shackling, and share their experiences in creating a framework for its use. So our guests are Judge Jay Butzman, who is the first justice for the Massachusetts Juvenile Court Middlesex Division. Prior to his judicial appointment, he was the founder and first director of the Roxbury Youth Advocacy Project, a community-based interdisciplinary public defenders unit, which created the basis for the development of a statewide department. He also co-founded Citizens for Juvenile Justice. Since becoming a judge, he has continued to present and write on a wide range of juvenile justice and child welfare issues. The list of his presentations, publications, activities, and accolades are enormous and cannot be given the proper due in this brief intro. He has spearheaded many initiatives in juvenile court, including one to redress the school-to-prison pipeline. Judge Blitzman is an adjunct at 4 universities, and by looking at his CV is to know that he is truly dedicated to creating a just and fair system that enfranchises kids and a strong community that helps kids gain every advantage for a successful life. David Shapiro started at the National Juvenile Defender Center as a Galt Fellow. He is currently NJDC's campaign manager for the campaign against indiscriminate juvenile shackling. David earned his Juris Doctor from Brooklyn Law School, where he received 5 public interest fellowships for his work on juvenile justice issues and co-chaired the Suspension Representation Project. He interned with several organizations throughout law school, including the Legal Aid Society's Juvenile Rights Practice, Youth Represent, the Center for Children's Law and Policy, and the New York Center for Juvenile Justice. John Elliott, who goes by Jay, is an attorney who practices in Columbia, South Carolina. He has represented children and young people for more than 30 years. He has received 2 national awards for his public interest legal work: the American Bar Association's Pro Bono Publico Award for work in advancing the legal rights of children, and the ABA's John Minor Wisdom Award for his work on death penalty appeals and other significant criminal litigation. He played a prominent role in the passage of legislation in South Carolina prohibiting the wholesale shackling of children in that state's juvenile courts. Jay started out in law enforcement and has been an observer of the criminal justice system in the country for nearly 40 years. So I'd like to welcome the three of you to the show.
Greetings.
Okay. So I really want to hear what prompted each of you to get involved in this issue. Judge, why don't we start with you?
All right. Well, first of all, thank you, Lauren, for the opportunity to participate in what I hope will be a productive dialogue. And it's an honor to be with such distinguished co-panelists. So my career in juvenile justice and criminal justice spans 20 years as a criminal defense attorney, 18 and a half years as a judge. And I started in juvenile court, where I am a judge now. And I was appalled from the outset about the practice of shackling adolescents that I was representing in court. The clear implication of the policy is that a youth is punished by the use of shackles and other restraints prior to an adjudication. So from the beginning, I felt this was, as you indicated in your intro, raised profound questions about compromising not only the presumption of innocence, especially in courts where judges are the adjudicators, because you send a not so subliminal message, and also compromises the rehabilitative ideals of the original juvenile court. And, you know, sort of interestingly, what moved the ball in Massachusetts, because we adopted an anti-shackling policy in February of 2010, was the observation, in spite of all the advocacy that had preceded it, it took the observation of one of our chief administrative judges who had never really been in juvenile court. And this gentleman was a career prosecutor, had been a Superior Court judge for many, many years, and he walked into a juvenile session just to see what was going on in the trenches, and he was appalled, and that was his word, appalled to see that youth who were status offenders, these are not even criminal cases or delinquency cases, youth who were before the court for offenses, civil offenses, which had been decriminalized, such as truancy, running away from home, were routinely shackled. Now, that got the ball rolling, and that was in 2009. By February 2010, we had an anti-shackling policy, which I hope to talk about during the next hour. And it's sort of interesting that a conservative jurist played a major role in galvanizing the effort.
Mm-hmm. David and Jay, what led you to be involved in this?
David, go ahead. Thanks, Jay, and thanks, Judge, and thanks for having me. I would say that I was always interested in juvenile justice issues since college, where I volunteered at a juvenile detention center in St. Louis City, and there they actually do not shackle youth indiscriminately in court. So I didn't see that happening firsthand. But my first encounter with shackles actually was on a tour of a facility in the District of Columbia here. And I was on a tour of the facility, and I was given the opportunity to actually put the shackles on. The belly chain and the handcuffs interlock, and they have leg irons as well. And so the process of putting this kind of instrument on was unnerving and uncomfortable and humiliating, even when I was just volunteering to do it. You have to sit on a chair and face the back of the chair with your lower leg straight out. At first, the tour director of the facility put them on me loosely, and the policy was to leave no more than 2 fingers worth of space. So I said, can I have it according to the policy? And I was then asked to stand so that the belly chains could be placed on me. And they're essentially a rope made of steel. They go around your stomach. And the process of putting that on is even more embarrassing. And the handcuffs intersect with the belly chain in a way I can't fully discern. The whole set's kind of close to your body, and your hands are crossed over in front of you. And so I was basically a human pretzel. And this is what I felt like as, you know, an adult.
As an adult. Male,
exactly, who is an attorney and volunteered for this. And so it made shackling quite visceral for me. And so that was my firsthand experience. And since then, I've been observing courts. And over the next hour, I'll talk a little about what I've seen in courts across the country and how kids are treated when they are shackled.
Jay?
Yeah, this is Jay Elliott. I first started representing kids in the family courts of South Carolina in 1976. And at the time, we had some really caring juvenile court judges here in Columbia, and my introduction to the juvenile court had to do with the what we call the rehabilitative ideal, the idea that the kids were before the court certainly to face the consequences of what they'd done, but at the same time they were they were there to get some sort of humane treatment with the goal of giving these kids some sort of a second chance in their lives. So I had some good mentors, Judge Jay Blitzman's in an earlier age. Over time, in our local courts, we began to accept the whole idea that kids needed to be kids who are in custody, not kids who are, you know, coming in off the street to appear in juvenile court, but kids in custody, kids who had been charged, typically in detention. And then sometimes having been committed to the reform schools, coming back before the court. Over time, we began to just simply accept or tolerate the practice of having these kids come in jumpsuits and belly chains. Frankly, based on my early experiences, not just in the family court, but in police work, the idea of marching someone into the courtroom, and especially a child, in belly chains was just simply offensive to me. And I vowed that it would change.
Well, you know, I provided a brief overview of the issue, and I really want to delve more into it. I know, David, you can help us with that. Here in Ohio, in 2007, the Ohio Public Defender's Office conducted a survey among youth who were recently committed to a youth state correctional facility, and they found 88% of the boys and 93% of the girls surveyed reported that they had been shackled when they appeared in their local court, and 30% of those children reported some form of physical harm after being shackled, and almost 60% reported having difficulty in writing, moving around, walking, or raising their hand. So, you know, David, maybe you can tell us, you know, is that what are you finding at looking at different states and jurisdictions about the rates of its use and how it's used and things like that?
Definitely, and that's a great question. It's hard to track how many kids are shackled, because when people think of a juvenile justice system, it's actually a misnomer, because every jurisdiction, or almost every jurisdiction in the country, has sort of its own juvenile justice system. So to track data across all those jurisdictions is very difficult. But what we do know is that the best way to achieve change is through statewide policies, because one county may shackle kids and another may not. Recently in Idaho, in northern Idaho, in Kootenai County, there was a child who was, I wish I were making this up, who was arrested for, and I say child because he was nine, for stealing a pack of gum. And I often use that line as kind of a joke line that you say, you know, he was arrested for stealing a pack of gum. Literally, this kid stole a 14-stick pack of Trident Orange Peach Ripe Mango Flavor chewing gum from a store. The police officers would not even put handcuffs on him. But he was sent to a detention facility, and from the detention facility, he arrived in court in shackles, and his mother saw him in court in shackles, even though the police themselves wouldn't do it. The prosecutor, the lead prosecutor, then said it was a mistake. They should not have ever charged him in the first place. These are the kids that are being shackled across the country, and this is the problem that we're dealing with. And it occurs in conservative states, in liberal states. It occurs right here in D.C. It occurs in Alaska, which is now ending its practice. They just passed in December a statewide rule to end the practice there. It occurs as far away as Guam, to Puerto Rico, up to Maine, which is also working on ending it, as is Puerto Rico. So there's a lot of movement jurisdiction and statewide to end this practice, which is phenomenal. And it's really the impetus has happened quite recently.
Stay for a second. I just want to follow up on a comment that Jay made earlier and then connect it to what David just talked about. You know, Jay talked about culture. You become inured. You become used to a system. In terms of looking at the culture, you know, states that have changed the policy have done so without the sky falling. So in my state, in Massachusetts, I indicated we created a anti-shackling policy by rule of court. It was promulgated in 2010. There have been really no incidents. Judges make the decision about shackling in the courtroom. Everybody is treated with dignity and respect. There have been no incidents. Florida adopted a policy, I think, in circa 2009, and actually the Florida policy was one of the reasons Massachusetts acted. We cite the Florida enactment and the policy that we promulgated, and I think a recent study indicates that in over 20,000 reported cases, there was not one incident where there was a security concern. So individualized assessments are made in courtrooms every day. They're made not only in minor cases, but they're made in the most serious cases. Massachusetts is a case which has jurisdiction in the juvenile court of all crimes other than first-degree murder. So we hear home invasions. We hear rape allegations. We have youthful offender jurisdictions. We could sentence some of these individuals if they're adjudicated as adults, but they're not shackled unless there's an individualized determination made in a courtroom. And but if you look at the if you step back and look at the issue globally, juvenile crime has declined dramatically in this country in the last 20 years, which is something I think that many people are not aware of. Yet at the same time, we've criminalized a lot of minor adolescent behavior, and we see referrals from social services systems. The juvenile court becomes the default system for school failures,
right.
Failures in the mental health system. And a lot of these children are not even accused of crimes. They're status offenders. They may become delinquent defendants because their status offense conduct has been criminalized through this valid court order, which allows states to then treat them as delinquent probation violators. But step back and look at really who the population of kids are. 75% of the youth in our systems of care and courts are nonviolent offenders. And again, the notion that you would have to restrain them, it's without a specific showing that there is a palpable, by that I mean a real bona fide security concern, is counterintuitive. And quite candidly, as regards status offenders or alleged status offenders, it seems to me to be immoral.
And let me follow up on that just a second, Lauren, if I might. Even in the event, and it will happen in any of these jurisdictions, even in the event of a youngster who acts out in the courtroom, who kind of comes a cropper, maybe throws a punch, even a tantrum, that should not signal to the court and the legal community that now the antidote is some sort of blanket policy on imposing restraints on all kids. That simply is totally illogical. Even in those jurisdictions that prohibit routine shackling, you know, if there's some episode somewhere in some court, that should not translate to some sort of blanket unilateral policy of shackling kids. Another thing that we really need to confront here and just lay on the table is this. The shackling decision is typically made by law enforcement or court security staff as a part of the law enforcement apparatus surrounding the courthouse. There, one reason shackles are imposed on these kids is to essentially punish them. In some ways, perhaps give them a sort of a little taste of punishment. Well, you know, under the law, anyone who walks into a courtroom not yet convicted is presumed innocent. And under the law, under the Constitution of the United States, any punishment prior to trial is unconstitutional. So that is one of the motivators behind the shackling decision, and it needs to stop. And I think it's going to be up to the legal community, lawyers and judges, to remind law enforcement personnel who are making these decisions that the use of restraints should be imposed not for punishment at all, but to address some concrete security concern.
You know, it's really interesting. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh,
I'm sorry,
okay.
Laura.
I just wanted to say how
ironic it is. You know, you commented on the top. You mentioned the case which talks about the right of adults not to be shackled in front of the fact finder. You know, it counterintuitive again is a kind word to say that we're going to treat kids in the name of treating them and helping them in a much more punitive way. That's always a concern about that's misguided, and that's led to some very, very unfortunate results in juvenile justice historically. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, no, that's important. And I just wanted to make sure that the three of you shared sort of all of the issues and problems which happened before we started moving into how each of your jurisdictions has been looking at this, because I know, David, you've been collecting affidavits. And so I just want to make sure, you know, people understand the potential trauma, the message it sends to kids about themselves, and any other stories the three of you may want to share that you have about the effect from what parents have said to you or kids or what you've seen.
So I want to comment quickly on the get a taste thing that Jay mentioned.
Sure, Judge.
Because this whole notion of scared straight, it's been beyond debunked. It's mythology.
Yeah.
The research is legion, and I'm sure, David, I'd love to hear you talk about that. This notion, even one day of unnecessary detention has been shown to be traumatic and have profound and very, very deleterious consequences. You know, having kids come in, and let's be real, a significant percentage, a disparate percentage or proportion of the youth in our systems are kids of color. So seeing kids come into courtroom shackled, not only does it conjure up, you know, the middle passage, but it's humiliating and degrading.
Right.
And reinforces very, very negative racial stereotypes. I'm sorry, David.
Exactly. And so I did have a few affidavits, and we've been collecting them as part of the campaign. They were really helpful in Florida as well as in Washington State in affidavits from medical experts and mental health experts in conveying to legislators, to judges, to law enforcement officers what the impacts of shackling are. So, for example, the punitive behaviors like shackling are actually associated with an increase in the likelihood of a child's subsequent negative behavior and with decreases in positive behavior, that restraint experiences may further prove to children themselves that they cannot control themselves and that they actually need external resources like shackles to help them gain and maintain self-control. And the problem there, as one of the leading psychologists, Larry Steinberg, has written about, is that self-control and that ability is actually one of the number one markers of showing when a kid can be rehabilitated, that controlling for all else, when a kid can exercise self-control, which I know I was not very good at growing up, is that this shackling experience prevents kids at a time when they are undergoing adolescent development, identity development, when their brains are plastic, it's a period of what's called brain plasticity, that they need these shackles and that therefore they're not learning the self-control, which is key to rehabilitation. If it's key to rehabilitation and these important facets of rehabilitation, then we're actually contradicting the rehabilitative values and notions in court. And that's obviously something that needs to change. So that's kind of the main problem. Then there are these language issues. So we have a speech-language pathologist, Professor Gwyneth Rust, and she's at University of Massachusetts. She says that beat gestures, these are kind of the movement of your hands when you talk just naturally. They assist the speaker and the listener in keeping track of sentence structure. And that's important because in order to tell stories or to convey to your attorney who's sitting next to you something that's going on in court is wrong or what your attorney should say in cross-examination, if you're prevented from doing that because you're being shackled, you're actually not able to represent yourself, not have your attorney represent you in court, and therefore won't have effective counsel in court. You may not only lose the case, but your constitutional rights are being violated. You'll be thrust into the system even more. And that's kind of one of these simple examples of just the fact that you're wearing handcuffs prevent that from occurring, these beat gestures.
Well, David, as we follow this along, wouldn't the overall effect of shackling a kid sitting at a defense table, I mean, wouldn't the overall effect essentially, sort of signal to the kid, look, you're just a sit here. You're not an active participant in this process. You just you remain mute.
Jay, it's even more than that. It's that they're dangerous. It's that they're criminal, that they are
less than human. Oh, I agree with that. Yeah,
of course. And that when you are, again, forming your identity as a child and as an adolescent, and you're being basically told by folks in positions of power that this is who you are, that's how you're going to act. That's how you're going to act then, and that's how you're going to act in the future. So when we shackle these kids, we're essentially creating criminals.
Well, you know, and I've heard all the I've heard all the the scientific and sociological kinds of arguments that can be made against this practice, but they all distill down to one sort of immutable truth, and that is, you treat a kid like an animal, and that's what he becomes.
Exactly.
So I think it's time for us to really move into what you've all mentioned are some changes that are happening. I do want to remind our listeners that they can pose questions in the chat room. We have a lot of people signed into that. Or if they want to ask you all a question live on air, they need to dial 347-994-1149 and push the number 1 on their keypad. So we've mentioned Massachusetts, Florida, and Jay, you were very involved, it sounds like, in what was happening in South Carolina.
Yes.
And you even had a bar resolution and that supported the statutory changes. So I don't know if we want to start there.
Well, certainly we can. The South Carolina bar, it wasn't just me. I mean, I certainly gave the presentation, but the South Carolina bar, to its immense credit, through its House of Delegates, went on record opposing the routine shackling of kids in the courtroom. It just so happened that there had been legislation that had been proposed by three senators, one a religious conservative, one an African American senator, and a third liberal Democrat. The legislation had kind of been languishing, and thanks to, in no small part to the South Carolina bar and others, it was sort of pried loose. It passed the South Carolina Senate, which has got 46 members, passed the South Carolina Senate 41-0, and then passed the House, which I think has 124 members, passed the House 103-0. So obviously, getting legislation passed is more than just floating a good idea, but I think it's a, and it takes work. But I think it's a tribute to the praiseworthiness of the very principle embodied in the legislation that it's really kind of a no-brainer.
It's worth mentioning that the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section has approved an anti-shackling resolution, correct?
That's correct.
I was asked to present to the ABA on that issue. You know, I went down there armed with the research of people like David and Jay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad that Jay talked about the broad-based coalition, because in presenting in that room, when we talked about this issue, I was pleasantly surprised to see that everybody agreed. There was some tweaking of language in the proposal, mm-hmm. but prosecutors agreed, defenders agreed, everybody agreed because of basic, you know, issues of equity. You know, in Massachusetts, when we went down this road in 2010. Our chief juvenile court judge wrote that shackling of juveniles in courtroom proceedings is antithetical to the juvenile court goals of rehabilitation and treatment. Then we promulgated a policy, and the policy, because I think one of the reasons that people maybe have some pushback is, okay, we're going to delay court procedure, this is going to take a lot of time. Well, in practice, that's really not true. The practice in my state is that a request for shackling, when it's made, is almost always made through security. We call them court officers in my state. They approach me, I notify the attorneys, and we have a hearing. And the hearing sometimes just occurs at sidebar in the courtroom. It could take a few minutes. Rarely is shackling permitted, absent individualized determinations based on enumerated factors that judges are supposed to consider. So there's no undue delay, and the culture has changed so dramatically since the enactment of the policy that even in serious allegations of crime, shackling is rarely granted. We have a rebuttable presumption against shackling, and shackling is warranted only if there's a showing of real concern, risk of flight, or that the individual, for whatever reason, may cause harm to anybody in the courtroom. So, you know, the policy has worked beautifully since its enactment. I just wish it had been around when I started in this field in 1975.
David, what other trends are you seeing in jurisdictions other than the ones that we've heard about?
Yeah, I'd say that just coming from a national perspective and being able to engage in all these different states, it's the coming together of advocates from organizations like local ACLU chapters and children's rights organizations, with public defenders, with judges, the media, and kind of forming coalitions to combat this practice. And again, as the judge said, encountering skepticism from opponents that, these kids not only should be shackled and that they all should be shackled, but that won't these hearings take too much time? And then, you know, you have to remind them, no, they don't take time. When these hearings occur, they're really short, but more importantly, they don't really occur that often because there's sort of a paradigm shift. There's a mindset change that you see in jurisdictions that have enacted reform. And it's been pretty persuasive. So in March of 2014, Boulder County in Colorado eliminated indiscriminate shackling. South Carolina and Washington State followed within the next few months. In December 2014, New Orleans passed a court rule ending indiscriminate juvenile shackling. In December 2014, North Dakota's court began to undertake efforts to actually put into practice what their Supreme Court had already said a few years prior. And that was around the same time, maybe a month or two prior to that, New Hampshire advocates realized that there had actually been a statute on the books for several years banning indiscriminate shackling that no one, including judges, including public defenders, really knew about because it was buried
wow.
in the education code.
Is that right?
It's right, and yeah. It was a surprise to me. I had in all my fact sheets the number of states, and New Hampshire was not one of them. So, you know, there was a lot of work to be done in terms of re-educating folks in New Hampshire on that issue, but now they're doing really well on it. On December 11th, Alaska Supreme Court, as I had mentioned, passed an order ending indiscriminate juvenile shackling that goes into effect next year. And then within the last few days, on January 8th, Nebraska introduced legislation on January 13th. Indiana introduced legislation on January 14th. The state of Colorado introduced legislation.
Wow.
So the stuff is happening quite quickly.
We have a question from a listener wondering, you know, because we're talking about indiscriminate shackling, are there any jurisdictions that have just banned shackling, period, on kids?
The answer is no, and my personal belief is that, you know, kids probably should not be shackled. But I think that would be a very hard sell to get everyone on board and to get legislators on board with that. But, yeah, these harms of shackling that doctors and medical professionals are talking about occur essentially with all shackling and not just indiscriminate shackling. There are some fairness issues where kids will react poorly if something is unfair. And so in that case, it's even worse where it's indiscriminate. But the just shackling, period, is harmful.
Well, I think it does kind of beg the question as well, though. What are the alternatives in maintaining security? What are the alternatives in maybe heading off some disruptive or unruly conduct? And some of those can be as simple as just stationing a court bailiff or deputy near the youngster so that he's being kind of supervised. Another, particularly in terms of flight risk, is just simply to close the door to the courtroom and lock it.
Well, I don't think we're going to get in the foreseeable future indiscriminate a policy banning all shackling. I think I think it's prudent to talk about rebuttable, perhaps, presumptions against shackling, absent something really, you know, serious. So I think now we've been focusing on individualized determinations of either flight or danger, and I think Jay, you make a really good point. You know, to think that we in the courtroom can't control the courtroom, I think, does the system a disservice. I like to think as a judge, I know how to run a courtroom. I like to think I have trained staff who know how to de-escalate situations. You know, court officers, we call them in our state, who work with adolescents. They know that if you're unnecessarily provocative with an adolescent, you may get more opposition. You don't become oppositional with somebody who may be oppositional because that begets further opposition. So we have training, and we know how to run a courtroom. And I think Jay is absolutely right.
Well, that's just it.
Court staff does the job.
You raise a good point, Judge, and in fact, this was one of my arguments in the South Carolina Bar House of Delegates. This kind of measure puts the judge back in charge of the courtroom.
And I would say that to add to that, in New Mexico, there was a judge who told me that there was one child who was acting out in the detention facility, and that the detention staff let the judge know ahead of time that, you know, we were going to want to have this kid shackled in the courtroom. And within day or two before the child was going to come to the court, they were behaving a little bit better, and the judge said, you know what, I heard, you know, there are some bad things happening, but I just don't want to have the shackles on. You know, we can put the shackles on later if they're acting out, or just, you know, take a time out, take like a 5-minute recess. And it turns out everything was fine. The child was unshackled in the courtroom. And as the judge was saying, as Judge Blitzman was saying, that's something that can happen, is when the judge is in control of their own courtroom, as they should be, it turns out that kids that are unshackled actually behave better than the kids that are shackled. They're not lashing out against being constrained by metal devices that surround and encapsulate them. And for that reason, And they feel they're being listened to a little bit more, that the process is more fair, these kids behave better.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the incidents where kids are getting hurt, we hear anecdotally, are when the kids are shackled, excuse me. So, for example, here in D.C., there was a story that a child was shackled and ran out of the courtroom and eventually passed by a security guard, and the security guard accidentally discharged her firearm. And this was used as an example of why kids should be in shackles. And those are the kinds of arguments that opponents are making to keep kids in shackles, which really makes no sense and is obviously a question of training and of proper courtroom behavior by all participants.
Yeah, let me interject something here that I've been thinking about for a long time now in the context of this problem. You know, to begin with, I think that September 11th, 2001, kind of ogred in sort of an overarching atmosphere of fear, and you know, and the security, the press towards making society more secure sort of spilled over, I think, into the courtroom. And then in 2005, in Atlanta, something happened that I think sort of created an impetus towards shackling everybody. And that was the case of Brian Nichols, who was he was on trial for rape. And he was left alone in an ante room with a female deputy who was much smaller than he and, of course, who was armed. And he grabbed her sidearm and shot his way out. He ended up killing a judge, a court reporter, a sheriff's deputy, and then later, just by coincidence, encountered a federal agent and shot him dead. Well, I think the lesson of that story is not we have to shackle everybody in the courtroom, whether they're 12 or 24. I think the lesson of that story is be careful how you run courthouse security. You know, you don't make stupid decisions about your personnel who are armed with guns, you know, giving prisoners easy access to them.
So, Jay, that's a great issue. You know, first of all, that was a rather infamous scenario. First of all, you have somebody who was a known danger. He's an adult. We're not talking about any more plasticity of brain development.
Right.
But it also opens up a consideration of a related issue. Having security armed in courthouses. We don't have that in Massachusetts. No court officer has a weapon in a Massachusetts, no court officer, or what you would call bailiff, perhaps in South Carolina, has a firearm in a courtroom. That begets opportunity. So that's something to think about. You know, David addressed this, earlier. We have 50 different systems of juvenile justice across the country, and plus the District of Columbia, and we have all sorts of different systems. We have county systems. We have where the sheriff sort of isn't responsible for security in a building. Here in Massachusetts, it's a different model. We have juveniles who are brought to court. But once they're delivered to our doors, we are in total control. So court officers internally run security. Quite candidly, you know, the chain of authority then is to the judge, whoever the presiding judge in that session is. So the decisions in that sense are maybe easier. But we don't have guns in the building. You know, there's another issue here that's maybe worth talking. We haven't talked about. There's a differentiation, of course, and I think opportunity for discussion between shackling in courtrooms as opposed to shackling during transport, given the variety of actors that are involved. So, but it's a complicated landscape.
It is, and I think, though, that the example, Jay, that you gave is also that we tend in this country to make policy over, you know, a horrific incident, and then that policy doesn't work for most people. And that's a problem that we see over and over again. We have about 15 minutes left, and I really want to spend that time focusing on advice that you have for your peers. What can attorneys do? What can judges do? How do you engage people? And what tools are out there to support people in having these conversations and in jurisdictions and looking at how maybe implement some changes?
Let me start from the judicial perspective.
Okay.
From the purpose of, you know, decorum and dignity in the courtroom, something which has been touched on, and also fairness and process, shackling gets in the way. So, I love to talk to young people in our status offense cases. I'm not as glib or apt to start up a convo with a child accused of a delinquent act because of this thing, this very, very important thing called the right to remain silent and the presumption of innocence. But if I had to engage, and sometimes I get off the bench and I come and sit at a table and try to have a conversation, I would really be compromised in that effort if the person I was talking to was in shackles. I don't think I would be greeted warmly if I descended from on high to come down and have a chat. I think treating people with dignity, it all goes back to being enfranchised. You know, there's the famous juvenile court case that started this all. We should all reread periodically, called In Re Galt. Galt was the 15-year-old youth who received the functional equivalent of a 6-year prison sentence for making telephone calls of the indecent adolescent variety without a trial, without any fact finding. He was presumed to be in need of treatment, and he was treated as such. An adult faced with comparable conduct faced a maximum penalty of a fine of $5 to $50 or a 2-month jail sentence. And the disparities there, again, are just dramatic. And, Galt also talks about what's really truly therapeutic for any individual, especially an adolescent, for a lot of the reasons that David already has eloquently addressed, is the fact that he is heard. And there's no substitute at the end of the day for fundamental fairness. That is that's what the system should be all about. More so for juveniles. why should we apply a different lens or view kids through a different lens? We've really got to really get it together here on this issue.
Mm-hmm. And I would contribute that there's several ways that defenders can get involved. Making changes in their jurisdiction is to contest when their clients are shackled. That should be the first thing that happens. It would be the first thing that your client sees is your advocacy on their behalf to get them out of the shackles. It's the first thing the client's family would see is if you're doing that. When you're conducting detention interviews, to discuss with your clients what it feels like to be in shackles, ask them if they would like to have you advocate for them to come out of shackles. And that way they see that you're fighting for them as well. I think those are important things that defenders can do individually. I think that law enforcement officers in the courts, or whoever's in charge of courtroom security in terms of applying the shackles, can question their superiors or have a discussion with the judge. And that really should have everyone at the table, defenders, prosecutors, probation, the judges, to make local court policies that really puts into perspective and question whether the way we've been doing things is the right way. Reaching out to national and local organizations and medical experts is really helpful. I've reached out to several national organizations that simply didn't know about this problem and now are getting quite involved. So not only the ABA that we've already talked about through the work of Jay Elliott and Judge Blitzman and others, but the National Council on Juvenile and Family Court Judges, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, Child Welfare League of America, the American Orthopsychiatric Association, all of these organizations and many more are starting to hear about this issue and are ready to put out policy statements and resolutions to make sure that we're not indiscriminately shackling our kids. And that's something that defenders, that policy advocates can do is bring as many people as they can to the table just by raising awareness. This again, as has been said on this call, it should be an easy win. It hasn't been because there's not a lot of attention drawn to it. There are other issues that people are concerned with, and there are organizations, particularly with law enforcement issues, that are offering some significant pushback.
Well, indeed, the community at large can play a role as well. You know, there are plenty of child advocacy and child welfare organizations probably in any jurisdiction that could weigh in, saying, as has been said by some folks, you know, look, if a parent did this, it'd be child abuse. You know, we need to stop treating our children in court this way, and some of these advocacy organizations could play a role by lobbying local decision makers. It's usually improper to try to influence a judge directly, although, you know, some jurisdictions are different. Some jurisdictions are quite supportive of judges being involved in their communities and being open to policy change and that kind of thing. But the community at large can weigh in on this issue in a variety of ways.
And for our listeners, a lot of these tools and things that David has mentioned are you can find at njdc.info. And David, do you have any other things that you want to share as far as, like, if people want to contact you about the type of technical assistance you can support around? Or?
Yeah, I definitely go to the website, njdc.info, and so if you type in Shackling, our webpage will appear. You can also contact me at dshapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O, at njdc.info. And we can provide affidavits, connect you with local advocates. We have folks working in almost every single state, and I've communicated with people in every single state. Memos and law review articles, resolutions and policy statements that are being drafted, fact sheets, ways that you can speak with others on this issue, strategies for getting op-eds into local papers. We can help you draft op-eds. So anything you can really think of involved in the strategy from a communication standpoint, from a medical or mental health standpoint, from a legal standpoint, from a policy standpoint, we can hopefully provide on the issue of shackling. And that's what we're here for.
Okay, and so I think it's time for some final thoughts from each of you about this issue, what you want people to take away, maybe where you hope we are on this 5 years from now.
Well, where I hope we are 5 years from now is we will have completed the transformation of the culture that allowed for presumptive shackling in the first place. I think experience has shown by looking at states like Florida, the 20,000 cases which have not occasioned any difficulties, experiences in Massachusetts, the lack of problems, that there's an upside against shackling. Because anything that creates and moves the dial more in the direction of fairness, I think, is in everybody's interest. I think it's better for public safety. Certainly it's better for youth. It's less traumatizing. It's less stigmatizing. But I think it also is good for public safety because to the degree that everybody feels enfranchised, that an adolescent feels enfranchised and is being heard, he will treat each one of us in the system with more respect. So I think if you really step back and think about it, it makes a lot of common sense. The fact that the ABA criminal justice section adopted the proposal to a presumption against shackling unanimously with the support of prosecutors in that room, I think is really telling. Because I think when the issue is thoughtfully and rationally laid out, not wrapped up with a lot of emotionalism, then I think if you look at the issue soberly, I think from every perspective you see that it's in our collective interest to really move in the direction of ending presumptive shackling.
And I want to second that hope, and to add to that, my hope is that in 5 years we will finally return to the notion that the courtroom is a place of dignity, whether you're a child or an adult. And while we may arrest and handcuff and even shackle criminals on the street to hail them into court, once they're in the courtroom, the lesson that we need to teach both the accused and the nation's and our citizens is: when you're in the courtroom, it is a place of dignity, it's a place of decorum. We make decisions in a fair and reasoned way, and that's the way a civilized society should be.
I think if we truly care about due process and rehabilitation, then we will end indiscriminate shackling across the country. And I think that's where we're trending, and I think within 5 years it'll be completely eliminated. I think that by the end of this year, at least 10 to 15 more states will have eliminated it. By statute or statewide court rule, and that's our goal.
Well, Judge Jay and David, I want to thank you all for being on the show, making time to discuss this important issue. I think the listeners got a lot out of it, so thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much.
Enjoyed it.
Great. And to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Goodbye.